Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
My guest today, Kevin Carey, is the director of the higher education program at New America. He's somebody I've known a long time across multiple different jobs in education policy. Really one of the most thoughtful people, I think, on higher education. Somebody who asks the big questions about, like, what are these institutions for and what are we trying to do with them? So I was really excited to sit down with him. We talk about the student debt relief issue that has sort of dominated the conversation lately. But it's a little bit of a somewhat shallow policy question. We wind up getting into much deeper issues. So I think you're going to learn a lot. This is really a conversation that takes this much further than a lot of the debt debates that are out there. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias. My guest today, Kevin Carey, is the director of the Education Policy Program at New America. Somebody I've known a long time, one of the sort of biggest, deepest thinkers, I think, on higher education issues, but wanted to talk with him immediately about this notion of canceling existing student loan debt, which has been, I think, discussed a lot since the election. And I mean, my understanding, I don't know if this is your understanding, but this is sort of bubbled to the top in part because a legal theory has developed that it can be done unilaterally. And I think, you know, I don't know, like any new president, like you want to do some stuff. And this is some stuff that can be done.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it was some form of loan forgiveness became an official part of the Biden platform basically at the end of the primary as a part of the negotiation to bring Bernie Sanders on board. And Biden essentially adopted the Sanders / Warren higher education platform, which included limited student loan forgiveness. And then the president-elect reiterated that a couple of weeks ago, saying he's in favor of some legislation that was, you know, in the offing last summer that would forgive the first $10,000 of each outstanding student loan. So not all the loan, just, you know, if you had 20,000, you'd still have 10,000 left over after that. But yeah, you're right. There has been a legal theory advanced over the last couple of years that has to do with this idea that the an administration's decision to not do something is presumptively unreviewable by the courts. This is a Supreme Court case originally in 1984 around the death penalty, actually, and the and somebody on death row wanted the FDA to declare that the chemicals that were going to be used to kill him should be reviewed by the FDA because they hadn't been approved for that purpose. And the Supreme Court said they don't have to do that if they don't want to. It actually also came up during the DACA debate, right? Because DACA is partly about not enforcing certain kinds of laws. And so people were saying, hey, well, you can just not collect loans in the same way and the courts can't stop you.
I mean, because part of it is who would even be the plaintiff.
Sure. I mean, there's issues about, you know, would anyone have standing, all this precedent? I mean, that's all new territory. I mean, it's important to keep in mind that if there's a federal judge out there who hates what you're doing, then their ideas about standing will change quite a bit. You know?
Right. One thing that I do think progressive-minded people should at least think about with this is that, like, selective non-enforcement of rules that are on the books is, I think, something you could potentially get a conservative dominated judiciary to agree to. But that might be put to, you know, different ends in the longer term. Like, generally speaking, we ought to be vigorously enforcing federal rules is like more the left's view of
right
how these things work.
I mean, I don't think no one believes that Congress thought it was giving the president or the Secretary of Education the discretion to just decide not to collect any student loan. I mean, if you look at, like, there is a provision, like Congress proactively put a provision in the law that said, if your college defrauds you, then the Department of Education can wipe away your loan. It's called the borrower defense provision. And, you know, the Obama administration spent an enormous amount of time in the waning days of that administration putting together a whole set of rules about how they would decide exactly who had been defrauded, particularly by some of the really terrible for-profit colleges like Corinthian colleges that went bankrupt. And then the Betsy DeVos Department of Education promptly put them in abeyance because, I don't know, they hate people who owe money. And they didn't want to do any of that. And so they spent years and years doing different regulations, and they've been kind of screwing over those kids the whole time, students this whole time. But like, all of which is to say, you know, they said, oh, here are the, under these circumstances, you can not collect loans. Apparently no one knew you could just not collect them and skip that whole process.
But that was like, right, so if Hillary Clinton had won the election, right, mm-hmm. policy would have gone in that trajectory. The Obama administration had some fairly elaborate formula that they were working on to say,
yes.
Not to say that, well, in virtue of the fact that you owe loans, but specific circumstances, mm-hmm. That they say, well, you were a victim of fraud. You were going to get forgiveness. But this is now a different idea, right? I mean, Biden's talking about a limited forgiveness program to limit the cost and I guess the distributive impact. But the idea is to broadly benefit, like, I guess not everybody, but at least like non-rich people who have student debt.
I mean, there are lots of ways you can do it, right? You can limit it to people with a certain income. You could only forgive undergraduate debt. And there is, I think, a very strong argument to say that you know, a disproportionate number of people who are in default on their student loans and are in real trouble actually have pretty small loan balances. There's kind of this counterintuitive inverse relationship between how much money you owe and whether you're having trouble paying it back.
Yeah, we should explain that. I mean, it's part of why the limiting is mm-hmm. weird, because you might think, okay, the people struggling most with student debt are people with like six-figure mm-hmm. loan balances. But when you look at it, like, who has a lot of student debt? It's like recent law school graduates.
People who went to
like have jobs in
med school, right? Business school, veterinary school. Although the veterinarians are not doing that well, actually, because they don't get paid that much to be a vet. Yeah, you know, it's, and so just one thing for our listeners, because this actually has changed over time. It's important to know nearly all of the student debt we're talking about is held by the federal government.
Right.
You know, there was a time in years gone by when like Sallie Mae was the great student debt, you know, overlord that everyone learned to hate. But the federal government makes nearly all of the student loans now. And the federal government was, in fact, guaranteeing a lot of Sallie Mae's loans back then at great expense, which is why we don't do that anymore.
Yeah, so this was a weird policy change because it for years had been talked about as a way to reduce the federal government's cost.
Which it did. Absolutely did reduce its cost.
Right, because the federal government was guaranteeing private student loans. And there was like all this other like administrative and marketing cost. And so it was part of the pay for the Affordable Care Act ultimately, right? Was to say the federal government would just do this directly, cut out the middleman, take advantage of its own extremely low cost of funds and do student loans.
With great success. You know, this was back in 2010. It was passed in the same legislation that passed Obamacare. There, at that point, there were basically two programs, a direct lending program that went all the way back to the mid-90s under the Clinton administration, and the program that you just described, where not only would basically private banks would make loans, federal loans, the federal government would guarantee them if they went bad and guarantee the banks a profit on their interest rate. So it was the greatest deal of all time, which is why it was a boondoggle. So we stopped that, saved tens of billions of dollars. Some of that was a pay for Obamacare, and the rest of it was actually used to increase funding for the Pell Grant program, which was a great idea. So anyway, so this is almost all government debt, which is why potentially President Biden could forgive it because it's money owed to the federal government right now.
I mean, I guess like one concern you might have is that doing a forgiveness program this way could destabilize that relationship, right? That, I mean, this ultimately wound up, I don't want to say there was no debate about this because it was very much discussed in its sort of policy community, but like in congressional terms, it got sort of snuck through suddenly very quickly while other stuff was going on. But one reason to not have the federal government act as a banker, I mean, because the federal government just can borrow money very cheaply. Mm-hmm. So it's in an accounting sense, very attractive always to have sort of direct federal lending programs. But if you're then going to end up, you know, having presidents do sort of one-off jubilees and stuff, you know, people might say, like, that's not such a good idea.
Well, I mean, it goes to some of the tensions inherent to federal student loan policy. Like, we do this to give people access to higher education, right? Like, it goes all, the federal loan programs go back to the late 1960s, early 1970s, when just in general, access to credit was much, much more restricted than it is now. But even today, you know, presumably, someone who's 18, has no credit history, has no assets, and has, like, little money, isn't going to be able to go into the private market and get a loan on the same terms that the federal government will give that person, both in terms of their interest rate and their ability to sort of repay the loans. So we do this in order to allow people to go to college, but then the federal government becomes a banker and then it tries to get all this money back. And there's this kind of basically kind of unthinking machine of giving money out and then trying to claw it back through the mechanisms of debt repayment that are sort of at odds with the spirit and the intent of giving access to higher education for people who can't afford it in the first place. So there's kind of a discordance, I think, between how we've chosen to finance higher education and what our ideals are.
Well, and it also sets up some of these, I mean, you know, you were talking about actual fraud cases, but in general, the loan program has the federal government, in a sense, paying for people to go to college, at least subsidizing it, but at arm's length, right? So, like, if you had said as an act of Congress, we want to start Corinthian College, like, that probably wouldn't have flown. Like, it doesn't, like, sound good. It's not
right.
Aspirational, right? If you sort of had to squarely debate it, like, do we want to go do that? But instead, it has a structure where, you know, if you qualify under certain terms.
It is, I mean, it's a remarkably open system, and I mean that in both a good way and a bad way, right?
Right.
So not only can anyone get a loan, regardless of their credit, but any accredited college can receive the loans. And that's the real problem, what you just said about it, Corinthian colleges, that, you know, the federal government basically doesn't approve who's in the system and out. It relies on nonprofit accreditors to be the gatekeepers for the federal financial aid system, which includes both loans and Pell Grants. And that system has proved to be really ineffective at screening out fraudsters. If you look at the one thing that every single horrible for-profit college that went bankrupt in the last 10 years and screwed over tens of thousands of students has in common is they were all accredited on the day they went under. The system had, you know, didn't stop them from getting in and didn't shut them down before they did all of that damage. And that's for political reasons. The higher education industry does not want the federal government to be in the business of making judgments about who should be eligible for loans and who shouldn't. Because that's what everybody wants. Everyone wants a lot of federal money and no oversight. And basically, our colleges get that right now.
And I mean, this is important because when we talk about student debt, quote unquote, right, it's this incredibly heterogeneous bundle of things, right? Mm-hmm. All the way from top medical schools to fly-by-night online degree programs, like everything in between, state universities, it's professional school programs that have a really high return on investment, it's master's degree programs of questionable financial value, mm-hmm. right? And the program, the loan program is very hands-off about all of that, right? It doesn't, you know, like a regular banker, if you want to get a mortgage or something like that, they make you assess the house, right? Like, they're not just, it's not just like, oh, it's a house. right? Like, you know, the business loan and anything like that, there has to be some kind of scrutiny. But for both good reasons and bad, it's designed to be open. It's not really done with that kind of banking lens of trying to make sure that these are high value programs.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the higher education is complicated to talk about because it is simultaneously a public service that should be subsidized and provided by, you know, government-funded, government-led organizations to people at no or low cost. And it's also a very large private market that provides very valuable services to people at market rates. And you can go all the way from one end to the other end of the spectrum, right? If you're in community college getting... You're a first-generation low-income student who's going to a community college for not very much money, getting, you know, your first couple of years at low cost. You're basically all the way on one end. If you're getting an MBA from the Wharton School at Penn, you're all the way over the other end. And the financial aid system sees no distinctions. It treats them all the same. So we sort of, the government's ended up being the like biggest lender in America without actually thinking through what it means to be a lender.
All right. So I want to get into some of these, you know, important conceptual issues. But I mean, first I should ask just what do you think of this idea of loan forgiveness? Like, does it make sense? It seems to anger a lot of policy wonk people, even as, I don't know what, lefty activists like the idea.
Yeah, I'm probably more loan forgiveness curious than a lot of policy wonks in DC. You know, some of my colleagues are just against it. I think what I would like to see is simultaneously some real structural reforms of how the higher education system works from a finance and quality control standpoint to solve some of the problems we just talked about going forward, at the same time that we help people with some of, who didn't have the benefit of those policies in the past. And of course, that's the rejoinder that, you know, that I think the Biden administration and people who support loan forgiveness would give, which is to say, right, we want to do that. That's what free college is. You know, so we're going to make it, we're going to solve the problem in the future, help the people in the past. We'll do it all at once. Now, the problem is that even if, you know, the Democrats win the two elections in Georgia in a few weeks, a 50-50 Senate is not an ideal venue for major once-in-a-generation restructuring of our higher education system. So what's more likely is you only forgive the debts from the past and you don't shut down the debt machine going forward. And I think the longer that goes on, the more complicated it gets.
Okay, let's take a break and then let's delve into that.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot-button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
So yeah, I mean, obviously, the like first blush issue with debt forgiveness is it doesn't, I mean, it may help people and that may be good, but it doesn't like fix anything, right? If we think that there's a problem with the amount of student debt that people have, a one-off backward-looking forgiveness does not, you know, resolve anything. And then I think when you go forward, you start getting into some pretty divergent policy visions, right? And there's like a left view that the whole move to debt financing was just really bad, right? That like we always should have been, you know, fully funding public universities the way, I don't even know if this is true, but people say we did through the 1960s, would be really cheap to go to college. And they have this free college vision going forward in which the federal government is supposed to, I guess, just ramp up tuition subsidies in a really serious way. I mean, Congress is probably not going to do that, as you suggest, but is that a vision that has some kind of merit going forward?
I mean, we definitely, it used to be more like that. It was never entirely like that. And again, we have to really make this distinction between undergraduate and graduate school. No one is proposing, graduate debt makes up about 40% of all outstanding student debt right now. No one, to my knowledge, is proposing to make private MBA programs free that currently cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. But that's part of that debt, right? You know, and so we need to kind of, there's this very kind of 100,000 foot kind of, I think, extremist view that's developed of student debt where, you know, every one of those $1.7 trillion in outstanding loans is a crime or an injustice. I don't think that's the case. Some of them are, but certainly not all of them.
And I mean, as you were alluding to, I mean, I think that that view tends to reflect like not even running through the numbers on what the debt is. Because like people will say that. Right, that like neoliberalism has burdened us with all this debt. But then the person who says that doesn't actually turn around with like a proposal to make dental school or programs free.
Right.
So, nobody actually thinks that. It's just that you have a slice of people who are sweeping under the rug the fact that that those programs exist and they account for a healthy minority of the debt.
I think that's right. So I mean, if we kind of put that aside and just focus on more limited forgiveness, you know, there is this big free college idea out there. I definitely think it makes fundamentally, I think it's born from this idea that we did something really smart in this country, which was to make public higher education low cost or free for everyone. It was a big part of our national prosperity. And then we screwed it up and we got rid of it. And the baby boomers just took it for themselves and then wouldn't give it to their kids. That's all essentially true. At its most basic level, that is what happened. It is terrible. We shouldn't move back in that direction. The specific idea of free college as articulated by, you know, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, I think has a lot of problems. I would come at it from somewhat of a different perspective. I wouldn't do it the way that they've said that they would do it.
Well, no, I mean, I think, you know, on the conceptual level, I mean, it's interesting because you hear these ideas from the left, but it's also people on the left who've tended to be skeptical of things like the Katz and Golden book on the race between education and technology, which actually, to me, makes the most persuasive case for a free college kind of thing. I mean, do you know that book?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, it's like they, you know, there's this sort of set piece in their narrative where it's like, and one day there was the high school movement and like people said, well, we should build high schools and people should go to high school, and it worked and it was really good. And then there was a version of that happening with higher education and like more and more people were going. And then there was a kind of a turn away, right? And more people kept going to college, but it was increasingly on this loan financed model. And we backed away from creating new public institutions in the sort of same scale that we once had. And It's a question for left-wing people who will then turn around and say they don't actually think education is economically significant. Mm-hmm. But, like, I think it is. People get, there's a certain, you know, wonk frame that gets very tied up on the distributive consequences of subsidizing higher education because people from more affluent families are more likely to go to college. But, like, we don't charge tuition to go to 10th grade, right? There's a view that it's good for society for people to do this. And I think it would be good for society for more people to get into higher education and complete it and hopefully, like, go to good programs. But, like, the basic idea of, like, onward and upward with educational attainment seems sound to me.
Sure, yeah, that's right. And you're right, it is some of the people who have been, and I agree with this to some extent, and even as a person who professionally is in favor of education, this idea of, like, educationism as a substitute for, say, labor policy. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's, I understand those critiques. I largely share them. But to just sort of say, well, you know, if you're not in favor of free college, then why are you in favor of free high school? Because they're not the same thing. And we have to grapple with the reality of the system that we have right now. So let me give you like a concrete example of sort of how free college would work and why it would be problematic. So I'll give you two examples of two universities, Auburn University, a public university in Alabama, and East Los Angeles College, which is a community college in California. Now, they're both about the same size. They have 30-some thousand students. Auburn University currently brings in about $450 million a year in tuition. East Los Angeles College brings in about $15 million in tuition, even though they have about the same size. Free college is essentially a tuition replacement program that would give $450 million to some combination of Auburn University and the people who attend it, and $15 million to some combination of East Los Angeles College and the people who attend it. That's what, like, the Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren plans would do. That seems insane to me. If this is like the socialist dream for higher education, Auburn is like that because it's a university for rich white people.
No. I mean, this is really important. I mean, because if you know, I won't ask you to associate yourself with this, but like, the way policy happens in the Bernie Sanders universe is that Bernie says things that are based on very high-level social democratic principles. Like, the richest country on earth ought to be able to make higher education free for its citizens. And then, like, some schlub has to, like, backfill, like, a policy idea that does that. And so the idea that they have is it's a federal matching grant to state governments that increase their tuition subsidy at their public universities. So, like, Alabama probably just wouldn't do this. Like, if we know Alabama politics, right? But if they did, it would be ridiculous because you would now have the federal government giving large sums of money to the most expensive exclusionary schools and very small sums of money to support community colleges, which are already designed to be cheap. And nothing about the institutions would change in a fundamental way. Like, you wouldn't be lifting up the quality of education available to, like, struggling kids. Like, it's a mess conceptually and doesn't, like, actually live up to, I think, what the kind of vague rhetorical mode of it is, right? It would be as a windfall to elite programs in blue states.
Well, it would be a windfall to states that have underinvested in higher education and a penalty to those that have invested it in higher education. And, like, the states will figure that out right away. Uh-huh. You know, and the state, you know, a state like New York or North Carolina, it's not all blue states. Like, North Carolina is a state that spends a lot of money on its higher education system. Pennsylvania is a state that does not, even though they kind of went the other way in the last election. Higher education finance is a mess in Pennsylvania. It's actually quite good in North Carolina. So we're going to reward Pennsylvania for decades of neglect by giving it more money to spend down its tuition because it hasn't done that in the past. So yeah, I mean, there are all these kind of ideas, and they're all derivative of this price-only frame of thinking about higher education, where the only problem is the cost, and we don't ask whether the institutions themselves are actually set up to finance are set up correctly to finance education. And it turns out they're not. You know, if you look at the work of someone like Adam Harris at The Atlantic, who's actually a fellow at New America right now, you know, he's writing what's going to be a fantastic book about how the sort of systematic underfunding of historically Black institutions, unsurprisingly, because of racism and all these sort of attendant reasons, we've just been not, you know, giving these colleges enough money more or less forever. And we still don't today. There's still states that are under, you know, judicial oversight by the Justice Department because of their, you know, racially exclusionary and discriminatory higher ed funding systems based on court decisions that predate Brown v. Board. Mm-hmm. If all we do is make that cheaper, we don't solve any of those problems.
Right. Well, and so this, I mean, right, so before Brown, right, there was this era of litigating within the separate but equal framework, right, essentially to say like, yeah, but you actually have to make it equal because obviously states were not doing that.
And they're still not. Maryland, which again, we think of as a progressive state, is still under the jurisdiction of the Justice Department because of the way that it finances historically Black public institutions versus the others.
And in all states, right, I mean, one issue with, obviously not all high schools or middle schools are created equal, but they are comparable products, right? Like high schools, like they look like high schools. Mm-hmm. They have classrooms. They teach similar subjects. Colleges are a much more diffuse set of things, right? I mean, in your Auburn East Los Angeles example, like it's not just that they charge different amounts of tuition, but it's like a completely different kind of thing.
Yeah, one's a research university, one's a community college. High school is fundamentally, until you get through grade 12, our goal as a society is to teach everyone about the same thing. Right. I mean, some people go farther and faster, and there's some divergence.
Right. We don't necessarily live up to the aspiration, but the core goals of the high schools are all the same. And like community colleges and research universities, they're doing totally different things.
So, I mean, I would be much more, what I would recommend instead of free college is to say, basically give the same amount of money to any college that voluntarily chooses to adopt, I wouldn't say free for everyone, but free for many, affordable for most. A uniform price structure, not a state-in or state opt-out, because then you have the Obamacare problem, which for political reasons, states will just turn down huge amounts of federal money because they don't want to be associated with the Biden plan or whatever. You give East Los Angeles way more money and you give Auburn way less.
And so you're saying basically make a deal that would be attractive to underfinanced.
Sure. In fact, under that kind of deal, if you offer a, say, flat per student grant amount, say $10,000 per student,
right,
to any college that chooses to adopt a uniform price structure, Auburn would say no.
Right.
Because it would be a financial catastrophe for them. Whereas a low-cost community college would say yes. Not only would they be cheaper, but they would have more money to provide a better education. They could start, they could have more tenured professors. They could have better facilities because we, you know, serially and criminally underinvest in the colleges that serve first-generation students of color and low-income students in this country.
Right, so because the structure of existing higher education spending is very regressive.
Right?
The most elite institutions have far more money than the institutions that are more likely to serve people from humble backgrounds. So a flat grant, particularly a conditional flat grant,
exactly,
is in effect strongly progressive because it would be a good deal to institutions that don't have much money now,
right,
and pretty unattractive to like UVA.
Yeah, and it's less coercive. You're not bringing institutions into the system that don't want to be. We have, one of the advantages and the strengths of the American higher education system is that we kind of let institutions be what they want to be. Mm-hmm. I don't want to like oversell the virtues of strong federal financing and control. You talk to plenty of people from like European countries where, you know, by and large, tuition is much more affordable or free, they don't have as much access. Not as many people go to colleges. People complain about the sort of public institutions that are overly bureaucratized and serially underfunded. And it's not a higher education nirvana necessarily that we should aspire to.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's worth talking about because you'll often see, I'll see American, you know, young Americans who typically went to fairly exclusive colleges often have a lot of debt will sort of talk enviously about the lower student loan balances of young Europeans. But European colleges, at least from what I've seen of them, they're kind of dumpy compared to American school. I mean, not compared to American community colleges, but it's more like community college. They're not as nice. They're not as fancy. There are a lot of European academics work in the United States, and there are no American academics working in Europe.
Right.
Like, they're at the high end, at least. Like, the American system is providing a much nicer product.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it gets back to sort of this question of the student loan debt and who to be angry at and all the rest of it. And like, sort of oddly, I find the anti-student loan movement is weirdly unfocused on who got all that money and the question of whether or not they were complicit in the problem to begin with. And who got it all is colleges got all that money, right? And the reason the colleges got more expensive is in part because some states have pulled money out of their higher education systems. But also, colleges cost a lot more than they used to. They spend way more money. They are a lot nicer. You know, take a picture of any public university in the 1970s and 80s and one now. I all but guarantee you it is a much nicer place than it was. The professors don't get paid that much. We've sort of adjunctified the professoriate over time, and so it hasn't gone into the academy, but it went somewhere.
And you have to distinguish between the short and the long term trend here, right? Because the student loan discourse really kicked off during the Great Recession at a time when a number of states were enacting cuts to their higher education budget. But if you look at the generational comparison, like, it's not disinvestment that makes the difference between 1970 and 2020. It's the spending levels are much higher.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, it's a little hard to think about. There's so many more students now in the system than there used to be. I mean, I think people don't quite realize what the millennial generation did to the American higher education system, where we increased the number of undergrads flowing in by almost 50% while keeping the number of institutions more or less the same. And then now, you know, one of the reasons a lot of colleges are in crisis is that the demographic wave has been crested about 10 years ago. And now we have, you know, almost a million students fewer, which is why, you know, a lot of these small private colleges are going bankrupt and so on and
so
forth.
It's like literally there are fewer 18-year-olds than there were 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's heading down. And to the best of my knowledge, I mean, I did a book that I had to research a lot of demographic projections. Yeah. It seems like... unless we, you know, adopt my 1 billion Americans policy recommendations, we will probably never see as many 18-year-olds as we had.
I think that's very possible. And I mean, you know, one reason I had a lot of enthusiasm for your book, 1 billion Americans, which I'm sure the Weeds listeners may have heard of prior to today. If you only ever have the same institutions forever and you never make any new ones, there's just a lot of stultification and lack of innovation, which I know is not a word we're supposed to use anymore. But it's just a lot of old institutions just wanting to kind of keep being what they are, or fewer. Now we sort of see some of the institutions in the private sector go bankrupt. And as a tangent, another problem with free college, it's only free public college. And there is, especially in the Midwest and Northeast, this like a significant part of our infrastructure for serving students, not just wealthy students, but students throughout the income ranges, is our private nonprofit colleges. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of, you know, small and mid-sized towns and cities that basically depend on the fact that 100 years ago, some religious congregation decided to charter a college there. Those places will go under, they're about to go under anyway. If we hugely ramp up the subsidies for their public competitors and give them no money, they will definitely go under. And I don't think that's really good for the system or the nation to just wipe them out.
Right. And so, okay, let's take another break. And I want to talk about the forbidden I word.
Support for the Weeds comes from Hydro. So I hit the gym in the mornings, and let me tell you, it's often a battle not to hit that snooze button again. And I'm sure I'm not alone in this. With Hydro, you can squeeze in a fast 20-minute workout. According to them, it'll work 86% of your muscles. Hydro is a state-of-the-art, low-impact home rowing machine that's actually designed by rowers. Sarah Frank is my colleague and works on the business side of things at Vox. She got to try out a Hydro. Here's what she thought.
While the Hydro workouts only took about 20 minutes, After I was done, I really felt like I probably had been working out for at least an hour. I could really feel the burn from my arms to my core to my legs, and it felt like I was getting a really efficient workout for my time.
This spring, you can join the growing rowing community at Hydro. You can head over to hydro.com and use code WEEDS to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's HYDROW.com, code WEEDS, to save up to $400. Hydro.com, code WEEDS.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this app. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
A few years ago, innovation in higher education was really hot, right? This was developing on a parallel track to this, like, student loan forgiveness narrative, was the idea that, you know, people would maybe, wouldn't even need to go to college in the future because you could like watch lectures on YouTube and take tests online. There were massively open, I forget what the second O was.
Online.
Massively open online courses, MOOCs. And that was gonna change everything. That hype wave seems to have gone down, even as we are now, in fact, doing a lot of education online during the pandemic. But you wrote a book about this, and I believe, still hold to the now unfashionable view that innovation and technology are important to the future in higher education.
I did. The book came out in 2015. It's called The End of College, Creating the Future of Learning in the University of Everywhere. Well, here's what's interesting. So, you know, the prediction at the time, which proved to be correct, not just by me, but like lots of people, was that higher education was in the midst of this huge migration toward online learning. That totally happened. Right? Mm-hmm. If you look at the I'm talking pre-pandemic, so not everyone who got sent home to do Zoom University in March. A year ago, the statement would have been just as accurate. There has been a very large and steady increase in the number of classes and the percent of people who are taking online classes. It used to just be sort of down market. Now, basically, every college and university in America, including the most prestigious, offer completely accredited, certified online degree programs in almost anything online. The part of the prediction that didn't come true is that this would somehow make college cheaper. Mm-hmm. And it didn't, because the only people who can offer college degrees are colleges. And so all of the savings wrapped up in going online has been captured by the existing industry, and none of it has gone to students. Right. It's all either gone into the pockets of the colleges themselves or a whole industry of for-profit consulting firms that basically come in, do all of the back-end work on these online programs, and then get to keep like 60 or 70% of the revenue.
Right. So this is like your institution, you have an accreditation, you have a brand, you have maybe some faculty, and that's all valuable, but like you don't know how to do an online course.
Right.
And so then there's these companies that do it, right? And they don't have brands or reputations or anything like that with the public. But they can capture a big revenue stream rather than like competing with existing institutions. They just kind of divvy up the pie.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So for example, listeners, go look up the MBA program at UNC Chapel Hill, right? UNC Chapel Hill, extremely prestigious, well-known public university, has a big online MBA program. See if you can tell, based on their website, who's getting the money. Now, I'll tell you, the answer to that question is a publicly traded for-profit company called 2U, like number 2, letter U, 2U Incorporated, which does all of the marketing, all of the intake, all of the IT, and gets, I think, 65-70% of the tuition revenue. Basically mentioned nowhere on their webpage. There are thousands and thousands of these programs now, online programs that are public-facing, very well-known public-private nonprofit institutions, but actually mostly being run by for-profit companies with an arrangement that splits the profits between the university and the company.
You say this like it's not a great thing.
Well, it's disappointing, right? And I guess one shouldn't be surprised that the industry figured out how to kind of keep doing its thing. there's a lot of, not only is the higher education industry protected by regulation and public subsidy, but there's an enormous cultural investment in the idea of college that only colleges can really fulfill. And our whole economy is kind of, or big parts of our economy are built around college credentials in a very mechanical way, right? Like you legally can't be a K-12 school teacher if you don't have a degree from an accredited university. And then beyond that, there are like just lots and lots of jobs that private companies decide you can't apply for unless you have this or that credential. And so, you know, the institutions that have an exclusive right to offer those credentials have a huge amount of leverage to charge what they want. And again, if you think about where did all that student loan money go? Why does the tuition keep going up? That's why, because they can increase the tuition. What else are you going to do?
You know, I mean, with the teachers, right, obviously you have a sort of slow moving bureaucratic process around licensing. And you see that in lots of different kinds of fields. You know, your other point is that even in a very unregulated marketplace, right, like you go to Vox Media, and it's like, it's all college graduates there. Not by law or anything in particular, but it's just normal, right? And like the central business district of any American city, absent a pandemic, is full of companies like that, where basically everybody they employ is a college graduate. And they're not like super academic in their focus, or necessarily anyone even cares about your GPA or what you learned or what you majored in. But that's very deeply entrenched. And it seems like as long as that's the case, right, people with the ability to go to a traditional college program are going to want to do that just on like, nobody's like, oh, I got a great deal on my kid's education. Right. Like if it's like you want to get like a good education for your kid, not like a weird knockoff suit or something.
Well, certainly nobody who lives in those central business districts and who or is kind of coming in and because of, you know, class and social construction and custom and affinity networks and all those things that sort of funnel people to the front door of Vox Media. You know, again, and you're talking about a company where probably more so than almost any job in the labor market, you can actually show your work.
Right.
Literally, you can show your work to people. So if there's a part of the system that should be least credentialized, it ought to be, you know, writers and journalism. And yet, you know, it still feels like an elite degree is kind of the minimum for ending up there. Somehow it works out that way, right? And that somehow, you know, incorporates immensely kind of powerful ingrained forces, both legal, social, and otherwise. Now, I mean, we don't want to like over-determine on the way that people in, you know, Washington, D.C. and the affluent suburbs think. Of course, you know, 45% of all college students start in community colleges. Mm-hmm. Almost none of them end up here. But it makes a big difference in terms of the white-collar economy and careers and all the rest of it. And, you know, again, I think that's where we should be focused, which is less on, you know, oh my gosh, I borrowed $200,000 to go to NYU, and more on, man, I really need to be able to get a bachelor's degree and sort of start a good job.
Right. But so that's the other way of focusing on this, right, is you look at that end of the lens where the schools are fairly cheap, right? But the question is do they have like resources and are they delivering quality that people, you know, really deserve, right? I mean, that's sort of, that's like the margin on which we are actually increasing education in our society.
It's certainly one of the margins. Again, I don't want to say there's no affordability problem. There certainly is. You know, college has gotten substantially more expensive over time. At the same time, a lot of people who go to college don't graduate. particularly once you get outside of the elite echelons of higher education, there are a lot of institutions that graduate fewer than half their students, fewer than a third of their students. Almost the worst thing that you can do is to borrow a bunch of money for a college degree that you don't get. The job market gives you no partial credit for going to college. You either have the degree or you don't. And these are the students who are much, much more likely to default. And again, kind of circling back to our debt forgiveness question, they're the people I would want to focus on first if we're going to kind of move in that direction. The people who are really, you know, their experience in higher education left them worse off because they trusted it, right? You know, like you don't enroll in college in the same way that you walk into a used car dealership, caveat emptor. You know, you think these people have your best interest at heart. You know, they think that you think they're educators, not a business. You don't think they're going to rip you off. And I'm not only talking about for-profit colleges here, but for a lot of students, the consequence is failure. And we should really focus on solving that problem. That's the worst problem.
It's actually quite shocking. I mean, look at some college that you haven't necessarily heard of. You know, I mean, you go to some town and it'll often have a not that well-known college in it. And like, look up the graduation rate. Or some of the weird, you know, the NCAA tournament is always a font of occasionally obscure universities. And I mean, it's really like incredibly low. And, you know, you were making the analogy to the used car dealer, but this really does go back to the financing, right? That if the loans were not guaranteed, then schools that whose graduates had very high default rates would not be able to stay in business.
Right. No, I mean, and you kind of get to this point sometimes where any move to regulate the industry to say, well, we're going to limit this to colleges that have meet certain benchmarks of performance, you get immense pushback from the higher education industry. And it really does, it behooves anyone interested in this issue to think about higher education as an industry, mm-hmm. just like the oil industry is an industry, and agribusiness is an industry, and pharma is an industry. These are large, powerful organizations that have economic interests in the status quo. They are interested in themselves more than they're interested in you. And their attitude toward federal policy is like everyone's. They want lots of subsidization and no regulation.
And that would be, to me, I mean, obviously the people who have not graduated and have these loan balances and they're not deriving any income benefit. I mean, those are the people who are most in deserving of help. But at the same time, I worry about forgiveness in that area because there's a need on the consumer end to sort of encourage people to be a little more thoughtful about what they're doing. Right. Like if you yourself, right, if you're a first generation college student and you're heading into an institution that has an incredibly low graduation rate, your odds are not great there. Like you need to find an institution that has some like a solid track record. And you don't want to make people suffer for fundamentally the sins of other institutions outside their control, but also we need to do something to punish institutions that don't, you know, reliably deliver value to their students or do something to steer students away from them and to just kind of say like, well, I don't know, that's a mess.
No, I agree. I mean, and that's why when the Obama administration was putting in place these regulations about how to forgive the debt of people who had been defrauded, they also included new regulations to do exactly what you're saying, to prevent more fraud in the future, to increase the standards on colleges that were in this position. And that's one of the reasons that Betsy DeVos didn't like it, because right. she basically hired a bunch of people who used to be lobbyists for these for-profit colleges, brought them in the Department of Education and let them run the place. So we absolutely have to do both things at the same time. And again, I would kind of like implore the community of enthusiasts for debt forgiveness to sort of join us in also trying to reform the system, which includes, you know, taking maybe more of a sharp eye on institutions that you may just think of as purely virtuous right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you said earlier, like maybe we shouldn't be surprised. But I do think some people get just naive about the concept of a nonprofit or a public sector institution, right? But, you know, it's hard to look at higher education without coming away from these sort of formal institutional setup does not change the fact that there are people there who like to have money and don't like to be regulated.
And again, I want to meet, you know, for all of the college professors out there, I understand you're not getting the money. I mean, there was a massive lost opportunity when all the millennials went to college to hire more tenure-track professors. The colleges didn't do that. They also have, in addition to having all this leverage over students who need degrees, they have an enormous amount of leverage over their own labor because they produce the people, right? So they kind of serially overproduce people with credentials to be college teachers and then, surprise, totally have them over a barrel when it comes to pay and labor conditions. But any attempt to try to regulate the industry, to bring some more consumer protection to the table, to try to raise the floor for what kind of institution should be eligible to receive these student loans, gets a huge amount of pushback from the college lobby, which is led by the elite institutions. That's the thing, Matt. Mm-hmm. They're so averse to the idea of regulation that even though like elite institutions aren't, ripping people off in the sense that, you know, most of their students do graduate, most of their students do go on to get good jobs, but they're preventing policymakers from regulating the rest of the sector because they just don't want any regulation at all.
Right. I mean, even if they're not the worst actors, like the current setup suits them very well.
Yeah, it's great.
And they're not interested in any kind of change. Okay, this has been a great conversation. I think it would be, I'd like to have you back on, talk about founding new institutions.
Yeah, I'd love to.
At some point, which we kind of alluded to, but didn't get into the weeds of. So thank you so much, Kevin Carey. Thanks to Jackson Bierfeldt for editing here. Thanks as always to our sponsors, and the Weeds will be back on Tuesday.